Hello and welcome to The Rest is History, the latest bonus episode where we will be talking Truss, Tolkien, and all things in between. Tom, is that much of a spectrum? Truss to Tolkien? I suppose
it is. God. I can't say it makes my heart sore.
We are in the middle of a absolute recording marathon, aren't we? Because we are...
Well, we're not in the middle, Dominic, are we? We're just at the beginning, actually.
We are at the beginning. That's a terrifying thought. Yeah. We've got this tremendous autumn schedule lined up where we will be peaking with, I think, something like 2 weeks of consecutive days of two podcasts a day, which is... You know, even by our own standards, ambitious. So we're looking for good news, aren't we, Tom? To sort of, you know, nice escapist headlines. And of course, the country is facing quite a grim winter, by all accounts, as all Western European countries are, because of the energy crisis. But Britain has a new prime minister to handle it.
Yes.
And we're not a politics podcast.
So I should say, first of all, we're recording this at, 1 o'clock? Just after 1 o'clock on Monday. And so the announcement's just been made. But I haven't been keeping abreast of it because I've been in the London Library getting books out on the Ashanti.
Wow.
Ready for our
That's
World
exciting.
Cup. Yes.
That's exciting.
It is. So I'm not completely on top of it. But I did bang out a tweet pointing out
I banged it out.
Salient fact that Liz Truss is the first Prime Minister to share a first name with a monarch since Viscount Melbourne, who was William IV's Prime Minister. And various responses to this. The first was to say that Liz Truss's actual first name is Mary.
So in other words, you were completely wrong.
No, I'm not, because I regard that as a technicality. Wouldn't you?
Okay. Well, no, I mean, if her first name is Mary, it's Mary.
Because Prince Charles's first name isn't Charles, I think, but everyone calls him Charles.
It is.
I mean, it'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It
I
is.
Thought it wasn't. I thought he was Charles Arthur or Arthur Charles or something.
He's not Arthur Charles. I'm going to Google Prince Charles while we, as we speak, do live research.
Okay, whatever.
His name is Charles.
All right. Okay. Well, I take that back. But isn't he? Okay. No, it's the other way around. He's planning to take on, I think, the name George or Arthur or something when he becomes king.
I've heard that he might call himself King George. If he calls himself King Arthur, I mean, that will be a shocking development.
I think that is what could save the monarchy. It could
well,
save
a thousand
the
years, Tom, of waiting for King Arthur to return. And finally he comes in, I'm here. Like, oh my God. That I was not expecting.
Yeah.
And I say that as somebody who's actually quite fond of Prince Charles.
I think that's a technicality. I don't think that matters unduly. Somebody else suggested George V and Lloyd George, but that's obviously, I mean, that's
clutching at straws.
And somebody else pointed out that actually this had already been raised on the Rest is Politics, which I gather is another podcast, which...
I don't know that podcast.
No. I must have heard it and subliminally remembered it. Anyway, so that's essentially all I have to say on the topic of Liz Truss at the moment.
Well, the big discussion in the newspapers is whether Britain has ever had a prime minister who comes in with everything quite so grim and gloomy, certainly in peacetime.
Churchill.
Churchill 1940, obviously, or indeed, actually, and you
Lloyd
could
George.
Argue Lord George during the First World War. I mean, there are, actually, I think people have short memories, because when Harold Wilson became Prime Minister for the second time in the spring of 1974, massive inflation, the miners out on strike, he only led a minority government. I mean, that was a pretty awful, and he had a very divided party. That was an awful inheritance. Margaret Thatcher in 1979, the Iranian Revolution.
Yeah.
Again, inflation. Britain had just been through the winter of discontent. I mean, that was also, I mean, the differences, of course, are in those cases, those people had all just won general elections.
Yeah.
Liz Truss has only won a ballot of the Tory membership. So she didn't even win the ballot of her own MPs, did she?
I don't really know anything about her.
So I think she has a very, very... There's also the issue, when you come in right at the end of a long period, I mean, Callaghan found this, as Alec Douglas Hume found this in 1963, 64, it's actually really hard to change the record. And to sort of say, I'm the new broom, bright new dawn, all that sort of thing. Don't you think?
I suppose, I mean, she is, she's kind of seems to be slightly returning to the, well, not slightly, very much returning to the Thatcherite free economics kind of stuff, which I guess is a kind of conscious repudiation of a slightly more centrist approach to economics that Cameron, May and Johnson had brought in. So,
yeah, I mean
she's a kind of Tory Corbyn, isn't she? I mean, she's, you know, the centrist stuff hasn't worked, so let's go for the red meat.
I don't know if they talked about this on that politics podcast that you mentioned that I haven't heard of, but she is a libertarian. She's a genuine libertarian. That's why she was a liberal. She was a liberal Democrat. I don't think she quite. Yeah, Mrs. Thatcher had a libertarian aspect to her, but there was more to Mrs. Thatcher than that. She was also a romantic nationalist, and she believed very strongly in the family and in national defense.
And she was a kind of ersatz Methodist.
Yeah, but Mrs. Thatcher, an ersatz Methodist.
Well, she becomes an Anglican, doesn't she?
But I think the Methodism is deep in her soul. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Liz Truss, I think the libertarianism is all with her, actually. I'm not sure what are the strings. We will indeed. It's not a popular elevation, I'd gather, with the Russia. they hold Liz Truss in very, very low regard. So,
well, that may be a commendation.
Yeah. Well, we shall see. I mean, I think she has a horrendous inheritance.
But so, Dominic, what people who would defend her say is that, and I'm sure this is true, that there has perhaps been a measure of misogyny in the criticism of her, and that perhaps she's being underestimated in the way that Mrs. Thatcher was. Do you think?
Yeah, and I think that's actually that is the obvious rejoinder, isn't it? So for those international listeners that we have who don't really know her, the clip that always circulates is her giving a truly excruciating speech about a decade ago when she was, I don't know what she was talking about food, wasn't she?
She was foreign trade or something.
She'd been to Beijing and opened up new pork markets, but also it was a disgrace that British children didn't grow up knowing the taste of a British apple and British cheese.
That is a disgrace. Was it?
It's an absolutely atrocious speech, atrociously delivered. I do sometimes wonder whether the teleprompter actually was moving too slowly, and that's why. But actually,
I thought she was waiting for applause that didn't come, which I gather that she did in her announcement this morning.
I caught a snippet of her speech this morning to when she won the Tory leadership, and again, she spoke very, very slowly. People who watch a lot of politics often laugh at that and mock it, but actually, some sort of political consultants and things say, oh, well, sort of snobbish university educated people will mock it, but actually it works because it hammers home to people who are only barely listening. They get the meaning much more than if you were gabbling away very articulately 19 to the dozen, that it's a sort of blunt instrument of a political communication tool. Anyway, going back to your point. So that's the clip that always circulates, the cheese and the pork markets. It makes her look silly. But I absolutely agree with you, Tom. I think one of the really underappreciated things is how women get such a rough deal in politics, and it's really impossible. So Theresa May, Hillary Clinton, you know, Mrs. Thatcher, actually, I mean, the examples are legion.
But Dominic, you could say that this is now our third prime minister who's a woman. Perhaps it's, you know, I mean, people really commented when Theresa May became, our second female prime minister. It's been much less of a talking point, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And so maybe it's just becoming completely, you know, nothing particularly to write home about. And likewise, if the reports of her, which presumably people will know by the time that you hear this episode, but the reports are that her chancellor will be Kwasi Kwarteng.
Yeah.
Her home secretary will be Suella Braverman, and her... Yeah. Foreign Secretary be James Cleverly, all of whom are not white. So all the four major offices of state will be occupied by people who are not white men. And again, that's quite a striking thing.
It is indeed. And the Tories seem to have, they're very good at that, actually. I mean, obviously, they had the first woman prime minister in 1979. It's why I think, actually, when Liz Truss eventually vacates the state, as obviously one day she will.
After her fifth election victory.
Kemi Badenoch will be the is
Badenoch,
the favorite
Dominic.
Is it Badenoch? Is that a Scottish surname?
Yes,
Tom.
It is.
Well, you're very au fait with Scottish matters, aren't you? So I'll defer to you on that. She's the favorite. you know, she's the long, she's the kind of crown prince, and she is, of course, black. And for the Tories to have a black woman leader, I mean, actually, they would love that, wouldn't they? Because that would give them bragging really rights.
Poke a stick in Labour's eye. Yes, it would.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, we will see. We will see. So, talking of power and
this is the
good
news,
and evil.
This is the big news.
The Rings of Power. So we did two episodes last week on, we did one on Tolkien, one on Lord of the Rings. And we were jumping shamelessly there on the Amazon Rings of Power.
We had planned bandwagon that 18 months before.
I know you had. It was a kind of tantric, wasn't it? Because we were desperate to do one on Tolkien.
Well, we talked about doing Tolkien when we founded the podcast. And I said, no, wait.
Yeah, you did. So The Rings of Power came out. Have you watched it, Dominic?
I have, Tom.
What do you think?
Do you know what? Ultimately, I quite liked it. There were things that I didn't care for so much, and maybe we will come to that. And a large part of that concerns Oirishness.
So we should bear in mind, shouldn't we, that lots of people will not have seen this. So we should just, and there may be people who have never even read Lord of the Rings. So this is set in the kind of before the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I was trying to explain to Arthur, my son, had the shenanigans. So basically what happened was the Tolkien estate had sold the rights to the Lord of the Rings to, I mean, New Line Cinema have them, the people who make the Peter Jackson films. But they sold that separately from the rest of Tolkien's work. So they then sold the rights to, it's basically the rights to the appendices.
I know, it's astonishing. And they sold them for more than Peter Jackson spent on making the film, the three films.
Right, exactly. So basically, the Amazon filmmakers can't use anything that appears solely in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. They can use stuff that appears elsewhere in the Silmarillion or in the appendices. But if it just appears, if it's a character, for example, like the Hobbits, who just appear in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, they can't use those in The Rings of Power. So it sets thousands of years before the events of The Lord of the Rings, the novel. And anyway, I thought about this a lot because, you know, we watched it was a sort of big event in our household.
So I'll tell you the parallel that just struck me. It's as if there was a film series about the Trojan War.
Yeah.
And then you weren't allowed to make a film that included any of the gods who feature in the Trojan War. So you have to make it about Kronos and Leia.
That's exactly. It is like that. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
I said to Arthur after we were watching it, I said, do you know what? If you had told me when I was your age that one day this would be on and it would be the most expensive TV series in history and you would see the home of the elves, Valinor and stuff, you would see the battle against Morgoth, you would see all this stuff, and there would be a whole new adventure story and Galadriel would be the hero and blah, 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 I would have cried with joy. And there was a sort of a little bit of me, it's easy to sort of be drawn into negativity and sneering, but there was a little bit of me when we were watching it that just thought, I'm so glad this is happening. And, you know, kids can see it and I can share it with my son and all this sort of stuff. So actually I watched it in a sort of quite a, I know you think of me as a very cynical person, Tom.
Not at all. I know, Dominic, that beneath the cynical carapace, there is a deep wellspring of sentimentality.
There is. Well, like all truly cynical people, I'm very sentimental.
I know.
So I kind of bought all that. The one thing I didn't like, though, was the Harfoots. Now, anyway, before we get into that, Tom, you tell me what you think of it, what you thought of it.
So I asked the rest of my family if they wanted to see it. There was a resounding no. So I watched it all on my own, which I'm sure diminished the sense of occasion because I just sat there feeling a nerd. I felt slightly bad about it. I thought the first episode was really dull and I almost didn't watch the second one. And then I thought second one improved considerably.
You didn't like all the sort of opening stuff with the...
I like the shots. I like the kind of one, you know, the one-off. But that was like, might as well have been a computer game. It was like the opening of a computer game.
Well, you don't like computer games, do you? So wasted on you.
However, so getting back to the Harfoots.
Yeah. They're the ancestors of the hobbits, basically. They can't use the hobbits, but they can put their ancestors in.
Well, you said you had views on it.
Okay, I have views. So here we go. When Peter Jackson did the film of The Fellowship of the Ring, the one thing, I mean, in all that film that jarred with me was the portrayal of the Shire and of the hobbits. He made them very comical at the beginning. He made the Shire seem comical, but he also made it seem kind of yokely. So people chewing bits of straw and mm-hmm. sort of looking foolish and scratching their heads and falling over. And there was also a definite Irishness to the music and to, frankly, some of the accents. And I sort of charitably thought, well, you know, it's actually quite hard for New Zealanders probably to do a sort of Somerset accent or whatever they're trying to do. So that's probably what lies behind it. But I was sorry to see that they didn't merely double down on it. They kind of quadrupled down on it for the Rings of Power. And they did it so much that the Irish Times, in a piece that I wholly agreed with, here's the headline, "The New Hobbits are filthy, hungry simpletons with stage Irish accents." That's $1 billion well spent. So the Irish Times was not happy at all and said basically they have portrayed these ancestors of the Hobbits as the worst kind of 19th century famine era caricatures of Irish peasants.
So that's the thing. You said 19th century. The whole array, I mean, so the accents, I thought, absolutely reflected a kind of late 19th century imperial metropolis perspective. So the elves, who are the elites, the people who rule these great empires, all have received pronunciation. They all went to Eton and Harrow and Westminster and whatever. The orcs and the kind of the more sinister kind of men are clearly from the East End and therefore to be viewed with.
Well, they were in Peter Jackson's films, weren't they?
Yes.
Meat's back on the menu, boys.
Yes. So that's going strong. You've got the dwarves are Scottish, so they're great engineers. You know, you can rely on them to go out to the empire and build a railway or.
But they're sort of uncouth,
down a river, aren't they? Or something.
Yeah.
Well, no, they're, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think
they're always downing tankards of beer and belching.
But everybody is. I think the salient thing about what they're doing, because they're going to come in and help forge the Rings of Power. And it's Khazad Dûm, which becomes Moria in Lord of the Rings, and it's an abandoned wasteland. But in this, I mean, it's spectacular and beautiful, and you see that, you know, that they are forging, creating things, and it's the dwarves as a practical, hard-headed race, exactly like the kind of late Victorians would see the Scots.
Yeah,
and then I agree. You've got the Harfoots as a kind of worst late Victorian stereotype of the Irish, and it seems bizarre that the most expensive series ever made, and an American series to boot, should basically be rehashing late Victorian stereotypes in a way that Tolkien never subscribed to.
That's the weird thing, isn't it?
That's the weird thing.
So Tolkien's Hobbits, I always have said this, Tolkien's Hobbits live in a very manicured, respectable, they are, as we've said a billion times in our podcast, it's Edwardian England, it's 1920s England, it's, you know, that period of privet hedges and suburbia. And of course, Tolkien doesn't want to portray them as suburban, but he wants to portray them as genteel. That's why they're always wittering about respectability and spoons and handkerchiefs.
Yes.
But those fools in the bloody Rings of Power, they're kind of chewing bits of straw. Lenny Henry doing awful.
It's so weird. And we've said this before, that Lenny Henry is from the West Midlands. Which is, it's madness. But it's so odd that an American TV series would subscribe to a kind of anti-Irish stereotype that Tolkien himself does not.
So I think this tells you something very interesting about the way that sort of American creatives, for want of a better word, a word I hate, I have to say, that they view both Britain and Ireland. I think they cannot compute. There is no room in their imagination for rural Britain that isn't kind of Miss Marple.
Yeah. Well, Miss Marple would have been better.
It would have been better. But I think their default is to say, rural and small must be Ireland. And I think they don't see how their view of Ireland to people in contemporary Ireland just seems incredibly patronizing. How they have, in a weird way, preserved the worst British 19th century stereotypes of Ireland, which they think are very kindly now. They think, oh, lovely, that the Irish will love this. They'll love being portrayed as leprechauns. I mean, they do this all the time in Hollywood movies. There are endless Hollywood movies.
I mean, those stereotypes were very, very rife in America as well.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I suppose, strictly speaking, since these are the ancestors of the Hobbits, aka the 1930s English, they should all really have Saxon accents, shouldn't they?
Well, somebody said to me, replied to me on social media or something like this and said, you know, you can't expect them to be still be Edwardian, you know, the picture of Edwardian gentility. But I mean, they could at least have been the picture of 17th century English gentility or something. I mean, they don't have to East go Indians. The full. I mean, so obviously my wife is Irish and she watched some of it. And I mean, it took her quite a long time to work out that they were Irish because the accents were so bad. And then she just said, I can't believe that they're doing, you know, that they're doing this and that nobody has said to them, stop.
Well, okay. So there was another thing that, and I know that they're kind of consciously situating it in the line of descent from the Peter Jackson rather cheekily. But what's the name of the actress who plays Galadriel?
Morfydd Clark. She's Welsh.
I thought wonderful.
Yeah, I thought she
kind
was
kind of amazingly good. And enough like Cate Blanchett, but also enough herself.
Absolutely.
To, yeah, really agreed. Good. But she's Welsh, and so there's a kind of occasional Welsh lilt to her accent. And really, the elves should be Welsh, I think.
They should be.
I mean, there was a kind of tantalizing glimpse of, because that again then makes sense that these are, yeah. You know, the Welsh are types for the elves because they are the people who the English move in and replace.
But I think, you see, we see this as English podcasters. But American producers, executives don't see this because they have their very fixed stereotypes, don't they? So they think English, therefore...
Well, this is why the BBC should be making it.
Aristocratic. Well, I mean, what, imagine on a BBC budget. But I think, yeah, it's funny. Funnily enough, the elves could be Irish. You could
Welsh
the elves
Irish,
as Irish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that would be completely fine. And actually, that would work better because then the Harfoots, who are meant to be the English, you know, they could have their English accents. Anyway, listen...
Okay, so we've sorted that out.
I think the bigger issue, which I was thinking about a lot over the weekend, is how comprehensively popular culture has eaten itself.
Oh yeah, go on.
All the sort of dominant things when I was a boy are still there, are still going, and are actually the dominant things now. So the Lord of the Rings, James Bond, Doctor Who, Star Wars, Marvel superheroes, you know, they're just endless iterations on a theme. I mean, a lot of these things were devised in the 1960s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s. The Lord of the Rings was, the Marvel superheroes were, Doctor Who was, Star Wars was. They're all still going strong, and nothing. And it's really interesting how stagnant, you know, that sort of world has become.
So the hardware is improving, but the software is just the same.
So yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, if you look at one of the big streaming services, Amazon have bet the house on Tolkien. Disney Plus, which is this colossal leviathan, has absolutely kind of carried all before it since the beginning of the pandemic. They spent billions and billions on Marvel and Star Wars to post-war.
Not interested.
You're not interested, Tom.
Not interested.
But the thing is that...
I have great pleasure in not watching it.
Hundreds of millions of people are. And I think it's really interesting that nothing new has been devised and that we seem stuck. We're also stuck in other things, aren't we? We're stuck musically.
Game of Thrones, perhaps. That's new.
But even that's cannibalizing itself, isn't it? Yeah. That's completely cannibalizing itself, but also that's purely, I mean, that's, you'd get no,
I know.
You'd have no Game of Thrones without Tolkien.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, but it's interesting, isn't it? The House of the Dragon and Rings of Power coming out at the same time, and they both feature kind of noble people with long hair. And it kind of brings home how the, Targaryens are quite a brilliant parody of the elves. Elves with mad power lust. Anyway, listen, I think we should move on. Have we got anything else to discuss? It was a historical anniversary on the 3rd of September. So that was on Saturday. Oliver Cromwell died on the 3rd of September in 1658. And Moray Dalvey asks, any further comments from us on his legacy? Well, I know that, Dominic, you are you're married to an Irish woman and Cromwell is your great hero.
So love a bit of Cromwell. Love him.
That's always a potent combination.
Surely, Tom, of all English or British heads of state, the most competent, most effective, most impressive.
He did it, and he was right to do it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Charles II, when he comes in 1660, basically continues an awful lot of Cromwell's policies, even maintains some of his staff, people like John Thurlow, the spymaster. There's a great deal of continuity there.
So I think today's episode on Portugal, on History of Portugal, is going out, and we briefly touch on the Cromwellian regiments who get sent by Charles II to help the Portuguese.
That's right.
And they perform very well. I mean, we have discussed this before. We've discussed the obviously the very different ways that he's seen between the English and the Irish, between people generally. It would be wrong to say on the right, because I think there's very much a constituency on the right that admires Cromwell. But let's say conservatives and radicals. And he's a hugely, you know, I mean, he's indisputably the most interesting figure in English history, I think. The most complex figure, the most controversial figure. I think a figure who is most proof against kind of reductionism.
Yeah.
And the problem is that two stereotypes of him were created at the end of the 19th century. The stereotype that saw him as the founder of English liberty, the founder of the parliamentary tradition. So that's why his statue stands outside the Houses of Commons, the Houses of Parliament. And the stereotype that sees him as a butcher drenched in blood, fertilizing the fields of Ireland with innocent blood, which likewise is bred of the campaign for home rule. And
yes.
And I think that both those stereotypes tell you more about politics of the late 19th century than they do about the historical figure.
Yeah.
I think both of them are kind of sell him lamentably short. You know, he's a much, much more complicated figure than that. But that is the fascination of him, I think. Don't you?
I agree, Tom, completely. I think one of the fascinating things is that almost everything you say about him can be contradicted. That he's so ambiguous. So that makes him really fun to talk about. You know, what can we truly say about any historical character? And so many of the things that we think are settled judgments are actually caricatures and simplifications. And when you look very deeply at Cromwell's life, he's a great example of that. But also, I think what's fascinating is that there aren't that many great examples of people in history who rise to the very top and have basically supreme power, but are so obviously riddled by self-doubt and guilt and uncertainty about the right way forward. I mean, we know from Cromwell's letters and all the things that he wrote that he's somebody who, even at the peak of the pinnacle of his sort of, as it were, his greatness, he's spending, you know, hours in deep in thought and agonizing reflection. What should I do? What does God want me to do?
It's a stereotype that people who might be described as super woke are often called by their critics Puritan. But I think that sells the original Puritans short, because the essence of Puritanism is a deep anxiety about one's moral status and moral purpose. And that requires constant self-inquisition, constant kind of inspection of one's motives, of the state of one's conscience and one's heart. And I think generally that's not true of people. I mean, I think there's a kind of, it tends to be a much greater sense of self-certitude. Among people who today might be called Puritans. So I think Cromwell is absolutely representative of that tradition. But the curious thing is that you're right, that you could often kind of say multiple things about him. And that would normally reflect a kind of quite a slippery, devious character, someone who is traditionally two-faced. I don't think Cromwell is in any way. I mean, he combines this kind of infinite sense, you know, all the many things you could say about him, with a deep inner steel, a deep sense of conviction. And that, again, is the kind of wonderful paradox about him. He's the most interesting character.
It is. It's the perfect thing. He's both an absolute idealist who believes that God has a plan for the world and that he is part of it, or hopes that he's part of it. And yet, at the same time, he's a ruthless opportunist and a pragmatist and a great commander and all these kind of things. And there's also a kind of rough humanity to him, isn't there? We know that he can be quite bawdy and he liked dancing at parties.
And, he liked music.
You know, he's absolutely not. I mean, people talk about him. I think Ronald Hutton in his book says, you know, Cromwell's often very described as in Parliament as being kind of red-faced and shouting and losing his temper and, you know, completely the opposite of this sort of incredibly chilly caricature of the man who supposedly banned Christmas, which he didn't. Anyway, he's such an interesting character, and it would take hours of podcasts, I think, to do him justice. And
well, we will.
One day,
we will
hopefully,
return
Tom,
to
we will.
Him. Yeah, we will. So we're in the middle of the Portuguese episode, so we hope you're enjoying those. So on Monday, you'd have had you'd have had Portugal on the Edge of the World and the Great Age of Portuguese Discoveries. Sam, who has drawn up our briefing notes, he wants Beyond the Euros and Ukraine episodes. This was the first series we've done focused on the history of one country, so why Portugal? Well, two answers to that. The first, very brute capitalist one, was that we were sponsored to do it, and listeners won't realize this because unlike the St. Patrick episode where we wove the sponsorship in through the fabric of the episode, and some people got quite cross about that. We've been very careful to keep the adverts for Wine 52, who are our sponsors, separate. So there was that. But Dominic, you've been wanting to do Portugal. I mean, a bit like the Tolkien, you've been itching to do Portugal right from the beginning, haven't
you? Yeah. I think it's a good example. Well, it's a country that lots of people in certainly in Britain or in the English-speaking world don't know a lot about. But also, I thought it was containable. You know, if you said, let's do a series about the history of Spain or France.
Too big, yeah.
I mean, you'd feel like it was too big, exactly. Whereas I felt with Portugal, it could be contained. And I also think it's a different way, actually, doing the history of the world.
Yeah, because that's the other thing, isn't it? That it is contained, and often smaller countries, by and large, don't tend to change the course of world history. But Portugal is both a contained country, but it changes the world. And that's pretty, I can't really think of a comparable.
Well, the Holland, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe Holland,
I mean, Holland maybe won't be a good example. So which country next? Will you, I know you would love to do the Netherlands, wouldn't you?
Yes,
that's a sort of passion of yours. And I've denied it to you all this time, but maybe I might relent.
Well, that's very kind. In the new year.
You may be. Don't pin me down.
In early January. Maybe we could do that. We'll see.
Yeah, we shall see. So finally, a very funny thing. Martin Tunstall spotted that on the, I think this is on the Apple sort of app that you use to listen to podcasts. It has a thing where it tells you about the rest is history. And it has a thing where it says, it lists the hosts and guests. And it says hosts, Tom Holland, Dominic Sambrook. But the first guest that it lists with a photo of him, presumably taken on the day he appeared on the show, is J.R.R. Tolkien. And he said, you know, huge if true. J.R.R. Tolkien did not appear as a guest on our show. He appeared.
I'd like to think we channeled him.
We did.
We channeled his spirit.
And Sam says, which of the guests who've been the subject of an episode would you like to have had as a guest? So would we have had Nixon on Nixon, Orwell on Orwell?
Oh. I suppose the closest we've come to that is Marc Andreessen on Silicon Valley.
Yes.
So that I think that's the only time we've spoken to someone who is a major player.
Yeah, in a moment of historical change. So if I had to choose, I think Orwell would have been an amazing guest, don't you?
I'd have loved Nero.
Nero. But would he be sufficiently reflective, do you think, about himself?
No, but he'd be great fun, I think.
I think Orwell would be,
Orwell
he could
be
really interesting.
Yeah.
I think actually Nixon could be quite reflective. If you ever watch clips of Nixon talking interviews, he's incredibly thoughtful and articulate, and I think he would have been a tremendous guest.
Well, what about Cromwell?
Cromwell, well, he would have started shouting at us or something, wouldn't he? I mean, that would be the fear. He would throw us out of our own podcast.
I think there would have been a lot of psalms.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, I mean, General Gordon.
I think he'd be terrible.
Yeah, he would.
Like he was on Love Island. He wouldn't enter the spirit of it. He'd find it alien and...
I'll tell you who would have been a brilliant guest and who will be appearing very shortly on the podcast. And that, of course, is the young Churchill. Because we're gearing up, aren't we, for a couple of podcasts on the young Churchill. And he, I think, would have been an absolutely marvellous.
So I read a whole book about that yesterday.
Did you? The Boer War book?
Hero of the Empire, The Making of Winston Churchill. Have you read that?
I haven't. I'm about to start reading My Early Life by Churchill.
It's absolutely brilliant. I don't think I've actually ever read a biography of Churchill before. It's a terrible thing to admit before embarking on a...
No, it's completely understandable because it's one of those things that people don't do. Like they don't read biographies of Shakespeare because they sort of, if it's all around...
I have read biographies of Shakespeare. I've read quite a lot of biographies of Shakespeare because they're much more manageable.
Right.
And I vaguely had at the back of my mind the derring do of Churchill's escape from the Boer prisoner of war camp. God, it's exciting. I mean, kind of hiding out in mines with albino rats and things. Astonishing stuff. And I was feeling very sorry for myself yesterday because it was the last match of the season that I was due to play, of the cricket season. And I had really terrible food poisoning, absolutely frustrated, so I couldn't play. I was just lying there feeling sorry for myself. And the book was it's by Candice Millard, came out in 2016. And it was so thrilling, such a page-turner that it quite distracted me from my mood of self-pity.
Does that have Churchill at Omdurman and all that stuff as well?
No, very fleetingly. It's very much focused on the story of his escape. And I will be plagiarizing it shamelessly.
That's fine.
Episodes that we record.
I started reading a bit of Churchill's My Early Life and it's unbelievably readable.
Yes. Well, he's such a great writer, isn't he?
Yeah. It's a rollicking. He's very funny, very self-aware. But then you sort of read about, I mean, we'll get into this when we do the podcasts. I found a story from the Sunday Telegraph. I'll probably read this out in, so it's published in 1900. during his Boer War sort of antics. And the headline is Lord Randolph Churchill's brilliant son, soldier, politician, war correspondent, and novelist at just 25. It's now a household tale, says the Sunday Telegraph, how he led the fight of the armoured train, how he returned into the hands of the enemy rather than desert his comrades, how he escaped from Pretoria prison. Who has not read the story of his dangerous dash for freedom? And you sort of think, that is 40 years before he becomes Prime Minister. I mean, whatever you think of Churchill, what a life. Oh, my God.
The backstory for Churchill. Wow. Anyway, so that's coming up in a couple of weeks, isn't it? And then on Monday, we've got the Loch Ness Monster.
Is that coming out on Monday? Next Monday?
I think it is. And on Thursday, is it German Romantics? The first Romantics?
Oh, yeah. That is a fun episode, Tom.
Okay, so we should flag this up. So I saw that you were being rude about me on the Discord.
No, you were being rude about me.
So there was debate.
I was being affectionate, Tom. No, I was never rude.
You were being rude about me. There was debate about guests. And people were discussing whether they like having guests or not. And you popped up to say that it was all my fault because I was constantly crowbarring my friends in.
Yeah. That's not rude. I mean, that's
Letitia
just a statement.
Something.
Letitia Ponsonby Smythe. Yeah. That's just a statement of fact.
I know. I knew exactly who you were thinking of. And you were thinking of my friend, Andrea Wolf, who is not even, I mean, she's not even English. She's German.
Yeah. And so obviously thinking of her. That's a lie.
You were very sniffy about this because she's written, and I have to say I was sniffy about it as well when she told me about it. So she's a very, very brilliant historian. She's written a lot of books about the history of gardening, and I can see Dominic's face, the eyebrows shooting as I say, but brilliant books on the history of gardening in the late 18th century. She wrote a fabulous biography of Alexander Humboldt, which was an international bestseller.
It was.
And this book is about the Jena set. So this is a compendium of philosophers and poets in the German city of Jena in the 1790s. And she told me she was going to do this. And Andrea, that is the most, I mean, why? It sounds the most unspeakably boring topic.
Did you actually say that to her?
I did say that to her. Because Schlegel and I just, oh God.
They're all called either Schlegel or Schelling, aren't they? Or Schiller.
That sounds so dreary. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. She completely makes a case for their importance, but she also makes it a rip-roaring soap opera. They're all jumping into bed with each other, falling out with each other, stuffing rotting apples into their desks, all kinds of mad stuff.
But crucially, Tom, that's an advert for the book. But what we should also say, she's a great guest.
She is a great guest.
So the whole conversation about guests is an interesting one because sometimes you can write the most brilliant book and be a terrible guest. And the ability, what we always find, don't we, is that to be a good guest, to just communicate in a fun and enthusiastic way, you know, complicated ideas or sort of historical narratives or whatever, they're slightly different from putting them onto the page. And she was brilliant at it, I have to say.
And we've been slightly wrestling because we don't quite know what to call the episode. So we're going out Thursday week. Should we call it the First Romantics or the... It's really difficult. But whatever the title is, do not be put off by it because it's brilliantly interesting.
Agreed. Actually, I will say this as well. You carry the Loch Ness Monster, and that's coming out next week. And that was your baby. And that is hilarious. That's really good fun, the Loch Ness Monster. So, and if you don't think it's a history podcast, you'll be surprised because the history of it is absolutely fascinating.
That's very kind of you, Dominic. So I think on that note of mutual harmony.
Yeah, I can't believe I would never, Tom, be rude about you. I mean, have I ever mocked your Portuguese accent, for example, on Twitter?
I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah, right. Okay, we have to go and record
four episodes.
So having done this, this is just a warm-up for recording four episodes of the rest of this history.
So what are we doing? We're doing...
It's part of our World Cup enterprise. We have been researching.
So what have we recorded already? We've recorded Dido, Queen of Carthage for Tunisia.
Yeah.
We've recorded the Somerton Man Mystery for Australia.
Yeah.
And you were about to do four.
Yeah, I'm absolutely pumped. Can't tell you how excited I am. Nobody, and I think I can say this with some confidence, there are very few people right now on these islands, Tom, who know more about the Costa Rican Civil War than I do.
Right. Okay.
That's a big claim, but I'm looking forward to justifying it.
Let's get stuck into the Costa Rican Civil War, and we will talk further to you all next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks, as ever, for everything. We hugely, hugely appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.